Okay, good evening. Thank you for waiting. I'm sorry, I was parking. I've been parking for the last 3 hours, so it's just like, thank you to Jacob?
Yeah, Jacob Liz,
thank you for arranging, and thank you all for being here late at night. You're all in the college, right?
Yeah.
And this is part of the requirement of that the college has over the last few years. So my topic for this evening, is there, we can actually project, or we can, from the internet, if I wanted to, is there possible or not?
From,
I can hear from here. And projecting where we projecting?
Over there.
I project.
Onto the blackboard.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. So I'm going to project not immediately, but in the next minute. But I should like, guess probably just log on and then I'm good for whatever I need to. Okay.
Turn around and push the button. Yeah.
Do you need to turn on the projector also? Or
Professor Min uses it for math class.
It's on?
Professor Min
figured it out.
Wolfram Alpha?
Oh, yeah.
Yo, if you can figure it out.
Yeah, it was a great class. Great final.
It's on.
Oh, it's
not.
Okay.
It was really hard.
I know. You think it's great for?
What's wrong with this?
96.
The battery is low.
There's one recorder that had one bar.
It got it last, like 30 recordings. It was used for Torah, right?
What'd he say?
So the battery's a little low. It was used for Torah, but the entire thing.
It's like Hanukkah.
I was drawing one time, we used a recorder that had one bar battery for literally like 10 weeks straight. And just wouldn't die. There was one time where we like said something that wasn't Torah and died.
Recording, boys.
Yeah. No, you do presentations. You do homework and then show how you're not bored.
I can start without. I'm going to start without it anyway. You won't have to do that thing. Okay. So I'm going to start. I want to just some introductory remarks. I want to show you some images, but I don't have to start with that. I'm going to start with some other things, and then the images will be integrated in. So my name is Richard Weiss. I'm the Rabbi of the Young Israel Hillcrest. I'm also an adjunct faculty at Stern College for Women. I have a background in medical things. I have an MD degree, but I don't use it because I decided I wanted to make a living, so I decided to go into rabbinate. Okay, it's supposed to be fun. In any case, even though we're only meeting one time, but rather than making it so impersonal, so if you don't mind, just tell me your names, even though I'm not going to remember them necessarily, but I think it's still important to be a little bit more personal.
Yitzi Klipper.
Yitzi Klipper?
Yeah.
From where?
Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Okay.
Jeremy Wienenfeld.
From where?
Cedarhurst.
Okay.
Chaim Zinn from Woodmere.
From Woodmere.
Benjamin Ramraz from Woodmere.
Woodmere.
Justin Wiener, Highland Park, New Jersey.
Okay.
Naftali Stern from Brooklyn.
Okay. I'm Austin Lord Side.
Okay, oh, your father is we were classmates. I think your father and I were classmates. NYU, we were shocked teacher or whatever.
Shiva Jarovsky
from Toronto. Shiva Freund from Cleveland, Ohio.
I went to high school in Cleveland, I went to Telt. Okay, I have cousins in Cleveland. Let's start another time.
Sydney Rockwood from Silver Spring.
Johnny Vidal from St. Louis.
St. Louis. Benjamin Patton from Say.
From?
To Say, New Jersey.
Not the list
from
St. Louis.
From?
Oh, from St. Louis.
Oh, St. Louis, okay. Okay.
Very good.
So I'm actually originally from Detroit, so for you Midwesterners, so we can come around together. So the two topics we're integrating tonight, which are certainly interrelated, are topics of contraception and the topics of assisted reproductive technology. So start with contraception, and use this board as well, I assume. In terms of contraception, before we talk about halachic aspects of contraception, I want to first talk about some of the basic medical aspects or biologic aspects of contraception. There are basically three categories of contraception. There are barrier methods to contraception. There are hormonal methods, hormonal contraception, and kind of put in a separate category in and of itself, perhaps partly because it's, I think even to this day, it's not fully understood how it works. There are certain suggestions, and probably some are more potent and cogent than others, and that is the IUD, which is an intrauterine device. Contraception can involve the woman using contraception, it can involve the male using contraception. Barrier methods, for example, there are a number of different barrier methods. Anyone knows some of the barrier methods? The basic idea behind the barrier method is that it prevents the male sperm from ever reaching the location where fertilization could occur with the female egg.
Condom?
The condom. The condom. A male condom. They will talk about a male condom. So a male condom is some kind of material, like a latex, I think it's made of, material that man puts over his aver, over his penis, and it's designed to basically serve as a barrier by which, even during normal tashmish, even during normal intercourse, he would be wearing it. At some point, he'd be applying it and putting it over his aver, and it would basically prevent the ejaculate, that which he ejaculates, which includes the sperm cells, from ever being deposited in the female reproductive tract. Just parenthetically, anyone have any idea how many, just interesting, happens to be fascinating, just the way God creates the world and the biology behind it. Approximately, when a male ejaculates, when he motzi zera, when he ejaculates, so on average ejaculates somewhere in the range of 2 to 3 milliliters of fluid. 30 mLs is an ounce. So 2 to 3 mLs is somewhere, 1 to 2 to 3/30 of an ounce. And in that ounce, anyone know approximately how many sperm cells, how many spermatozoa, but sperm cells, we'll just refer to them, are included in that 2 to 3 small amount of fluid? Any idea?
300 million.
Approximately 300 million, approximately 100 million per ml. So somewhere in the range of 200 million to 300 million per ml. It's interesting that to be fertile, the number of sperm that are generally considered to be adequate per ml is about, I think it's 20 million. So there's a significant excess of sperm that are generally available. The reason for the number is because it's not easy for sperm to get from the vaginal canal through, if you're familiar with anatomy, through the cervical canal, through the uterus, up into the fallopian tube. That's not easy. It's not easy for a number of reasons. It's relatively a long journey for a cell to make that. And also there are a number of kind of inherent barriers that the woman's reproductive tract has. Sometimes it has to do with the pH environment and other things. So in order to enable at least enough sperm to reach where fertilization usually occurs in the fallopian tube, say you have to have millions of them so that only, generally speaking, a few hundred from the hundreds of millions, generally only a few hundred ever make it to the fallopian tube fertilization. That's why you need so many. So that aside, so the male condom basically prevents any of that, unless unless it wasn't applied early enough, unless it leaked, unless there was a hole or some cut in the condom which allowed leakage, but basically it collects it. From a halakhic perspective, let's integrate halakha as we go along. From a halakhic perspective, this is the most serious halakhic category or type of contraception. This particular barrier method of using a male condom, which is the most serious, because of the fact that, and generally speaking, the poskim, maybe not quite unanimously, Chaim Ozer Grudzinski is the one who's considered to be a minority, but a gadol minority in this, but even he didn't necessarily, I think the poskim say, didn't necessarily permit it as a general, but only perhaps in a special situation. But generally speaking, the poskim do not permit male condom. That's like, halakhically, in the hierarchy of which are the most serious halakhic forms of contraception, the male condom by far is the most serious form. There are poskim that I think would permit, I think, I'm trying to remember now. I don't remember that, so I don't want to start off the top of my head. But male condom is probably the most serious in terms of temporary contraception. There are permanent forms of contraception which are surgical, but we're going to leave those out. So male condom is most serious, and the reason for that is that probably the single most important halakhic factor in determining whether a particular contraceptive method is halakhically compatible or not is whether or not the interaction between the man and the woman, the intercourse, the tashmish mita, is basically normal or not. If it's normal, then whatever happens and results in whatever results or whatever the outcome of the sperm or the egg or the oocyte is not as important. As long as the basic physical interaction between the man and the woman is a normal interaction, then it's permissible. This is not considered halakhically normal, because normal is that, number one, that the interaction between the two does not involve any kind of material that would be separating the male's organ from the female organ. So that itself is not normal. That itself is not necessarily a natural experience, particularly for the woman and also for the man, but I think more so perhaps for the woman. And more so, the fact that the sperm, the ejaculate, the semen, is not deposited in the female reproductive tract. The normal intercourse involves that, if it's possible. That's the normal intercourse. This prevents normal intercourse. Once it prevents normal intercourse, then it's considered to be hotsoas zera levatol. That's the main issue with contraception halakhically, is hotsoas zera levatola. Pardon me. Hotsoas zera levatola, the basically producing semen, sperm cells, and semen for waste, for no purpose. There's all discussion in the poskim about the seriousness of hotsoas zera levatola. What kind of iser is it? Generally considered to be an iser lav. It's a machlokas actually, whether it's an iser d'oraisa or an iser d'rabbanan. And I think the general assumption is that it's an iser d'oraisa, but either way, it's certainly yosef to do. And hotsoas zera levatola, so the seed is wasted. Wasted in the sense that it's not necessarily wasted. Wasted can be that it doesn't go for the purpose of trying to have a child. But just the fact that it's not necessarily going for the purpose of having a child doesn't mean it's levatola. That's what the Rishonim point out. Whereas if a man is infertile, let's say the concentration of sperm cells, let's say he has 5 million sperm cells per ml. So generally he would be considered to be infertile. It's very unlikely that he would ever be able to fertilize the eggs of his wife. So there are ways medically around that. But we wouldn't say that the sperm cells that he is ejaculating are levatola, because even if they may not be going for the purpose of trying to become pregnant, they are still in the normal context of intercourse, and that makes it not levatola. So the hotsoas zera can be either for pregnancy or for a normal intercourse, a normal interaction between a husband and a wife. In this case, it's not going for any of that. So that would be the most. The other barrier methods include those primarily that involve, yes?
I was going to say another method.
Yeah, go ahead.
Vasectomy.
I'm sorry?
Vasectomy.
Vasectomy would be. I'm not sure if it's categorized under barrier. That vasectomy is generally considered to be an irreversible form. I guess kind of more focused on the reversible ones, but that is an important one. Vasectomy is generally considered, although sometimes it can be reversed. I think the general approach when surgeons do a vasectomy when they cut the vas deferens, which carries the sperm from the epididymis to the penis and through the urethra and out, so if that's cut, it prevents sperm from ever being able to be ejaculated. So that would be a surgical procedure that generally is considered to be irreversible, even if in some situations it may be reversible. But the assumption of a man going in is that it's, I think, irreversible. That you could say that's a barrier. I guess you could say it's a surgical irreversible barrier. It basically prevents them from getting. So that makes sense that it's considered to be a barrier. So that's more of an irreversible. In terms of reversible, any other questions? There are two that are similar but not quite the same. They involve a diaphragm and a cervical cap. This is a bad illustration of female reproductive tract. That's the vaginal canal of the vagina. This is the cervix. This is the uterus. And here on either side is the fallopian tubes. So the sperm is deposited here in the vagina, travels through the cervix, the cervical canal, which is like the neck. Cervix is like neck, like cervical collar, the cervix is neck, that's the neck of the uterus. It goes into the uterus, which widens, and from there goes to the fallopian tubes. The uterus is where the pregnancy develops, inside the walls of the uterus, that's the cervix. So there are two barrier methods that are similar. The diaphragm is a structure, don't recall what it's made of. The diaphragm is, I don't know if it's also made of latex or some kind of material, and it has to be fitted for the woman herself, but the diaphragm basically goes up against the cervix. It doesn't cover the cervix, but it's a diaphragm that kind of serves as a barrier to prevent sperm from getting into the cervix. It's a diaphragm, so it's a barrier placed by the woman inside her vagina, deep in against or near the cervix, so that it basically serves as a physical barrier. The cervical cap kind of fits over the cervix, and again serves as a physical barrier preventing sperm from being able to penetrate through the cervical canal. Generally speaking, these are recommended to be used together with spermicidal material, whether spermicidal gel or spermicidal foam, some kind of chemical substance that actually also kind of neutralizes or damages the sperm. Generally, these are combined. Optimally, the diaphragm or cervical cap, so you put the spermicidal gel or foam inside the cap or inside the diaphragm, and both together have a very high rate of success. I don't remember the exact rates. That might even be into the 90s, but certainly into the high 80s in terms of methods. Male condom is considered to be quite effective as well. Exact percentages, I don't know offhand. Spermicidal gel or foam can also be used by itself, but it's not optimal. So that the likelihood of becoming pregnant is increased with spermicidal gel alone as opposed to in conjunction with diaphragm. And diaphragm alone or cervical cap alone is less effective than with spermicidal gel or foam. The general consensus in the postium is that this diaphragm cervical cap, with or without spermicidal gel, are considered to be halachically compatible. I just want to make a disclaimer, not poskening any shilas, so any shilas that you may have now or in the future, I defer to your local Rabbanim, whoever it is that you ask the child is from. I'm just kind of presenting the halacha of the Lola Maisa. But nonetheless, the general consensus of the post-game is that diaphragms or vocaps from cyanogel gel foam combined with them or alone are considered to be halachically compatible because they don't interfere with the normal interaction between the man and the woman. They don't interfere with normal intercourse. Once the intercourse is not interfered with, then it's considered to be derech tashmish and derech bia, and therefore it's not hatzaras zera levatola. Even though the zera is not being allowed to gain entry into the deeper parts of the female reproductive tract and are not being allowed to potentially create a pregnancy, that's okay. If there's a reason why contraception is being used, that's okay. The consideration is that it's not levatola because of the fact that the sperm is being deposited for the purpose of a normal interaction between the husband and the wife. That defines why it's not levatola. Yes, go ahead.
Is it possible to say that someone could do the fact that the male isn't actively doing anything to be mostly levatola? Is that a possibility as to why?
I mean, the woman is placing something, which right now has no effect on the sperm. Then he deposits it naturally, and then it kind of happens naturally. That's a very nice svara. It's a very nice svara. I don't know if any postgames say that. I haven't seen it myself, but that I haven't reviewed all the literature. Trust me, so I'm sure that there's a large body of posting that I haven't seen. They may suggest that. I don't know. It makes a lot of sense. It's a very nice part, actually. The fact that neither one is doing anything active. There's a discussion in general in the postkim whether a woman has the isser of Hatzaras Levatola, if she causes active destruction of the man's zera. That's a separate discussion in the postkim. In terms of, let's say, the man, though, but you're focused on the man correctly, so he's not doing anything active. He's just depositing the sperm, and then the chemicals, the diaphragm, the cervical cap are taking over from there. So it's not Hatzaras Levatola because he's not doing it. It's supposed to the condom, where he is actively depositing it within the condom itself. So there, he's actively involved. It's a very nice verb, but it makes a lot of sense. I think it has to be combined with the fact that now there's the other flip side of what you're saying. Is what you're saying is really like two parts of the same coin, and maybe you need both parts. The fact that on one side of the coin, the fact that the interaction is normal, and part of that means that he's not doing anything active to cause any destruction or interference with his zera, which means that the normal intercourse. So that's perhaps it's another way of saying the same thing, or it's another part of the slur. Okay, very good. Somebody else had some. Yes?
How is using this spermicidal material not an issue?
So the reason, even though it is actually causing damage or inhibiting the sperm from being able to move forward, or inhibiting or causing damage to the membrane of the sperm, cell membranes, whatever exactly it does, the chemical, it's not considered to be. So you have to, combining, let's say, the two spars that we just mentioned, the fact that what happens to the sperm after it's deposited is not what is halakhically most important. What's halakhically most important is not whether or not the sperm actually does have the ability to fertilize the egg. What's most important halakhically is that the manner in which the husband and wife engage in intercourse and the release of the semen and sperm is done in a normal fashion. What happens subsequently is not. Perhaps in part, based on the svara you had before, is that the man isn't doing anything. It's just naturally interfering with the sperm. It's not that he's taking the chemical and depositing it on his sperm or in any way interfering. It's happening kind of derech agav or memela. But the fact that the intercourse, that seems to be a major thrust in the post, and the fact that the intercourse is normal, that itself means that whatever happens subsequently. So the Tzaras Levatola is not based on whether or not we enable potential pregnancy to occur, but whether the intercourse and the interaction between the husband and the wife is what's normal. That seems to be the primary consideration. All of this assumes that another halakhic consideration has been addressed. What's the other halakhic consideration in terms of contraception? One is Hatzaras Zera Levatola, which relates most specifically to the type of contraception being used, but in broader terms, whether or not contraception should or should not be used, or can or cannot be used, regardless of which method, involves what other mitzvah? Peru Revu. The mitzvah of Peru Revu. That's the larger mitzvah that a couple has to address in terms of whether or not contraception is appropriate or not. Once Peru Revu has been addressed, then the specific type of contraception has to be taken into consideration, what we've been discussing. We'll come back to Peru Revu in a few minutes. In terms of hormonal methods, basically there are hormones. The hormones that involve, let me just briefly talk about this. In terms of hormones, hormonal methods involve some manner of administering hormones to the woman, whether it's oral, which is the most common form of contraception used in the United States, whether it's an injection, whether it's a patch, whether it's a device called a vaginal ring or a Nuva ring that's inserted vaginally. Either way, there's hormones that are involved. And the hormones interfere with the normal process in the woman of basically ovulation. Ovulation involves the release of a mature egg, also known as an oocyte. And in order for pregnancy to occur, a woman has to undergo ovulation, where her ovaries, or one of her ovaries, which are over here, her ovaries release a mature egg or oocyte every cycle that a woman goes through during her reproductive years. Generally speaking, she ovulates or releases one mature egg or oocyte. These hormones prevent ovulation from occurring. They basically prevent ovulation from occurring. There are two types of hormonal methods. There is what's known as a combination method, just for your interest sake. On an exam question, I won't ask you this kind of detail. A combination method where they combine two hormones, basically some form of an estrogen. But there's a reason, though, that it's important to be aware of it, just for knowledge sake, and progesterone. And the other is progesterone only. I'm going to tell you. Progesterone only, sometimes known as the mini pill. The combination of estrogen and progesterone are the hormonal methods that, leaving out the details of the mechanism, prevent ovulation. Progesterone only also inhibits ovulation. This is a little bit more effective than this. This has a little bit more of a failure rate. Not a lot, but a little more than the combination. But one situation just to be aware of, for just your own knowledge, why a woman would use progesterone only rather than a combination of estrogen and progesterone is if she's breastfeeding. If she's breastfeeding, so the combination interferes with milk production. The progesterone only does not. So a woman who's breastfeeding doesn't want to have her milk production decreased or insufficient or inadequate. So then, generally speaking, she doesn't use the combination. She uses the progesterone only. Be it as it may, what is most important for our purposes is that hormonal methods prevent ovulation. And therefore, there's nothing to fertilize. So even if normal intercourse, no barrier, no cervical cap, no diaphragm, no spermicidal gel, nothing at all, the sperm gets to the fallopian tube, there's nothing there for it to fertilize. This is considered to be probably the most compatible halakhically. There are some who are not as comfortable with the barrier methods, even though I said the general consensus of the postium is that diaphragm and cervical cap and spermicidal gels are considered, and that is the general consensus, but I wouldn't say it's unanimous. Hormonal is more broader in terms of acceptance in the postium because it doesn't do anything to anything, except it prevents ovulation, but it has no effect on sperm, so there's no Hatsara Zeila Vatola. And again, the fact that the zera is released by the man in the normal fashion in the context of intercourse, but the fact that it has no ability to fertilize anything, to create a pregnancy, because of the fact that ovulation was prevented, doesn't make it levatola, because the normal interaction, again, is there. And again, say in that case, nothing's happening to the zera. Just not being able to end up combining with an egg. The last method, just briefly, is what's known as an intrauterine device, which happens to be worldwide the most common form of contraception. In other countries, because hormones are expensive, to do this on a monthly basis and pay for, you know, every month hormone pills, it's expensive. So worldwide, in other countries, like in third world countries and developing countries, the intrauterine device is most common. So outside of the United States, generally speaking, I don't know if Europe is still hormonal, I would think, but the intrauterine device is the most common, and it's a device, whatever its nature is, details of which we're going to leave out, it's placed inside the uterus. It's an intrauterine device. It's placed inside the uterus, and it somehow prevents pregnancy from occurring, whether it interferes with the movement of the sperm, whether it interferes with implantation, whatever it may be. It also happens to be that what's interesting, parenthetically, about the intrauterine device is that it's generally designed for long-term contraception. If a woman just wants to use contraception for a couple of months, an intrauterine device is not appropriate. Because, first of all, it's a procedure, a surgical procedure, not totally invasive, but requires to be placed by a physician. And it has some risk associated with it. So it's designed to be in there for an extended period of time. And they are effective. There's some intrauterine devices that can be in for 5 years, some that can be in for 10 years. These are long-term contraceptives. Those are the three. And intrauterine device is also generally considered by the post-gym. The general consensus is that it's not a halachic issue. Whatever it does, it prevents implantation, but it doesn't do anything to the zera. Even if it interferes with the movement of the zera through the uterus, so then it's like a barrier. But it's not considered to be, generally speaking, a halachic issue. But the most serious issue is the male condom. That's a very serious issue. It happens to be that... Right, so that's the first thing. So let me just... see if I can project, just so you can kind of see. So what do I need to do?
Sorry, I have a question.
You sure?
I was just wondering, when you said that there's no issues like with the hormonal one, or the most common?
The general consensus, certainly a strong consensus for hormonal, in general for IUD, but
my
I think that's second.
This is how most people pass them, that there has to be like a monkey folio or like certain anterior to like...
Oh, so we have to come back to the Peru Revu. You're right. So, okay, you're right. So we have to do that. So you know what? So let me just project. Just want to show you just some of the actual contraceptives, and then we have to address Peru Revu. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, that's... okay, Mozilla. Okay, fine. Okay. And then... Oh, it required... Oh, no, I don't need this count, right? Right, creative.
No, you don't. What is the website or?
I'm gonna images. Yeah, I'm through. I guess we'll do it here. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Different methods. That's an intrauterine device. It's generally like a T-shaped structure that goes inside. They're showing you like a container of hormonal pills. Generally speaking, they're showing you, I think, a classic example of 21 and 7. Generally speaking, what a woman would do if she's taking hormonal pills orally is she would have a container where 21 active pills and then 7 placebo pills. Of sugar pill or whatever it may be, in order to basically simulate her cycle. So she takes 21 active. During those 21 active days, she would not be ovulating. And then the last 7, she, which would be past the time that she would expect to ovulate, could take placebo so that she could then have a normal bleeding, normal period subsequently, and then start again. So that generally speaking, ovulation occurs mid-cycle. So once she's past, 21 days, she's she should be free of that. Generally speaking, there are halakhic implications of taking the hormonal pills as well, in terms of both preventing bleeding and whether a woman has to be concerned about expecting her period during that time, as well as what's known as breakthrough bleeding, but we don't need to get into that. This I think is a cervical cap, if I'm not mistaken, that covers the cervix. Maybe this is the diaphragm. It's placed against or near cervix to prevent. It's a kind of, I think it's a latex or some kind of material. And then again, you can put spermicidal foam inside. And here you have the interior of it. You put spermicidal foam inside. They have. Okay, let's. Here they have actually an example of, here's a condom, that's a cervical cap, that's a diaphragm, so that other one probably was a diaphragm. Cervical cap, diaphragm. The other one, by the way, I should also show you, right here, there it is. But I was looking for the other one. Okay, that's fine. There was a circular thing maneuvering. Okay, fine, that's good enough. Later on. Okay, so let's come back to that issue and then go on to fertility, and then I'll show you something with that. So in terms of the general question, in terms of approaching contraception, there are two halakhic issues. We focused on Tzarzera Makala, which has to do with specifically selecting a halakhically compatible form of contraception. The larger issue, really before getting to that, is the issue of Pru or Revu, namely, the fact that a couple has an obligation of pru or vu. Okay, let's assume that the man is commanded, the woman not as much, but certainly she has a kiyama mitzvah and she's mesayeya, whatever other halachic aspects may relate to her. But nonetheless, certainly as a couple, there's a mitzvah of pru or vu. So if a couple, so to fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu, basically have to have a boy and a girl, let us say, let's assume that a couple is newly married. Let's give that scenario. You have a couple that's newly married, and therefore they now have an obligation of pru or vu. They want to postpone trying to have children for whatever reasons. Come back to that in a moment. So the last question is, are they allowed to postpone the mitzvah pru or vu? We're not going to assume that a couple is permitted to just indefinitely postpone pru or vu, because that would be a bittul of a mitzvah saseh in the Torah, pru or vu. Say for chinuch, it's the first mitzvah, and say for chinuch, pru or vu. So that not. So even if they want to use a halakhic compatible contraceptive method, they still are not kind of incompatibility with the separate obligation of pru or vu, which contravenes contraception regardless of the method. So they want to delay. So what are some of the reasons for delaying? So there are economic reasons. Sometimes. There are educational reasons. They want to finish their education, their graduate school, or whatever it may be. Educational and economic, oftentimes are kind of like part of the same package. And there are other considerations, like that of, if you will, personal, meaning that if a couple gets married, it's not unreasonable, depending on the couple and the individuals and their age and their maturity, all that, to want to focus on establishing their own relationship before focusing or having the responsibility of a pregnancy and a child. One shouldn't assume that the 9 months of pregnancy are free of responsibilities towards the pregnancy. Even without complications, there are responsibilities and there are issues, and the woman gets tired and this issue, that issue. So just in terms of developing their own relationship is a potential consideration. There are more serious considerations as well. If you have a situation where a woman has some kind of medical condition, where having a pregnancy would not necessarily jeopardize her life, that we're not going to talk about that extreme, but may have some exacerbation of her medical condition. There may be medical conditions, and there may be also, I want to mention, genetic considerations, meaning what if you have a couple where both of them are, let's say, carriers, leaving out whether they did or didn't do premarital genetic testing, whether they should have or they shouldn't have, let's leave that out. Let's just assume we have a couple who's married, and both of them are carriers for Kasach's disease or for cystic fibrosis or something like that. And they're concerned about having a child that's affected. So then the potential of having that child, so that would be a consideration. That doesn't mean, therefore, that they can, therefore, just not involve in having children at all. So that would be a situation where you could actually combine assisted reproductive technologies to allow them to have healthy children. And in terms of their normal interaction in the context of intimacy and intercourse, perhaps use a halakhically compatible contraceptive method. So that might be a consideration. But I don't want to focus on that as much. You should be aware of it. I'm going to focus more on these, economic, educational, and personal. So I want to just read to you from Sefer Encyclopedia Halachatit Rifuit, Encyclopedia Halachatit Rifuit by Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg from Shaar Tzedek Hospital, pediatric neurologist at Shaar Tzedek Hospital. So he wrote a wonderful, now I guess, six-volume work on halacha and refuah called Encyclopedia Halachatit Rifuit. And Dr. Steinberg quotes the following. It's an encyclopedia. So he quotes the following regarding miniat herayon zmani, temporary, short-term contraception, b'tchilat hanisuin, beginning of marriage, regarding the issue as discussed about peruvu. Yes, misha kasav shezug tzayir, a young couple, shedayin lo kimu misas peri riva, that have not yet fulfilled the misery. They have no children. They're not permitted to postpone the fulfillment of the mitzvah at all. Even if just to be able to kind of matriculate from their studies, or to be able to have a proper job, or a proper home, or a proper residence, or a proper apartment, even in order to learn Torah without the responsibilities or economic burdens or whatever the case may be. So the mitzvah peruvu is a mitzvah that they have to start trying to fulfill immediately, and none of this is relevant because they can't get to this point because they aren't able to surpass that. That's the Yesh Misha Kosav. He quotes in the footnotes, he quotes some of the poskim who say that based on the Rambam. Yesh Misha Kosav, Shenarotz Iraha Lemeda B'Seminar. The woman who's learning in seminary, she saw for Yolda Yeladechet, she already has one child. Or Magishon, she feels in Tamshich Let, if she soon after has another child, she's going to have to interrupt her studies and loans, whatever loans she was given for her studies in seminary or in college, and she's going to lose those loans or default on them or something like that. So Muter Lekacha Gululo, she can take pills, that's the hormonal method. And the Yahirayon, the Tikufa Mukbelet, for a period of designated time at Siyam Limudah until she finishes her studies. Or perhaps the same would be for if the husband has that situation, presumably, if not just one-sided. That's because she already has one child. So first of all, just coming back to that for a moment. Truth is that if a woman has a child, is one child, so they haven't completely fulfilled the mitzvah of Revu, they've partially fulfilled it. So does she have to become pregnant right away? So part of that is not such a simple question. To assume that a woman has to immediately, as soon as her cycles begin again, and as soon as, let's say, she finishes breastfeeding, let's say after a year or so, and immediately begin trying to have another child, that depends partly on her own health, on her own medical condition, her own welfare, and whether or not that's too much of a burden for her. It also depends on the development of the child that she already has, and whether or not she can give proper focus, and other considerations. But this was a particular consideration. Then he quotes, just to point out, Yesh Mishikoslu, and there are those who've written, Shebi Yameinu, that anyways, in our era, Lo Mitchatnim Beglil Shlosh Esrei, we don't get married right away at 13. Why 13? Vafil Lo Begil Shmon Esrei. The Mishnah says, 13 is not really relevant halachically. The Mishnah says in Avos Ben Shmona Esrei L'Chuppa, which means that the mitzvah pruravu, or a mitzvah getting married and pruravu, although normally all mitzvahs begin at bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, these mitzvahs don't begin. The obligation to get married, the obligation to have children, doesn't begin until Shmona Esrei. Doesn't begin right away. But we generally don't get married right away at 18. So, in general, we all postpone the Mr. Fervu. It's the general approach. We postpone it. So, therefore, if it's being postponed anyway, so postponing it a little bit more is not so bad, because we're postponing it anyway, meaning that apparently whatever it is that is felt to be justifiable to postpone marriage and having children at the optimal age halachic anyways is enough of a reason to perhaps postpone it a little bit more, for a little bit more period of time. That's why he writes, he quotes the poskim in the footnotes to say that if the couple obviously agrees and the method is used that is appropriate and it's done for a short period of time, but I would say that it's not just for random purposes. If they have a bona fide reason, which they have to discuss with the Rav, that whatever the case may be, or after having one child they're not ready for the next child, or whatever other considerations in the relationship or other economic considerations, in other words, there is a basis for it, for his money, for a short period of time, whatever that may be. He discusses that, 6 months let's say, whatever the case may be, and then to go on from there. Yes?
This is whether or not they have a child already, or only if they have one child?
This would be even without, even because he says that they won't get married, so that in the beginning of the marriage, even without having a child. The other case was a woman who stipulated already has a child, and he feels that she can't have another child now because it's going to interfere with her education and her loans and like that. This is independent of that. This is even a newlywed couple.
So, but the first thing he said in terms of that he seemed to be like low-plug, like not at all.
Right, that's the Yeshmisha Kasav, that's one approach, and then he quotes this other approach. He quotes these two divergent approaches, halachically, so just to mention that. Okay. Just want to go on from here. We have, Marv is at 10 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
Right, so I don't want to leave you out of this, so we'll be done by 5:02 for sure. So let's go on to fertility issues. So this is in terms of preventing. Let's talk about trying to facilitate pregnancy for a couple that suffers from infertility. Anyone know the definition of infertility for a couple? Infertility, by the way, approximately, you don't need to know this, but approximately 40% of infertility causes are based on the woman. About 40% are based on the man. And about 20% are not identifiable. So I mention that only to point out that one should not assume that infertility, even though in Chumash the focus is on infertility of the imahos, but in terms of actual medical information, infertility is commonly due to male factors, and commonly due to female factors, commonly due to combination, commonly due to other factors that are not easily discernible. So, yes?
Are we including black infertility in this?
No, this infertility is a medical definition. That's a good point, a good question. So how do you define infertility medically?
The inability to have children?
The inability to have children for a couple's inability to have children, or we'll phrase that as a successful pregnancy, meaning maybe the woman gets pregnant but has a miscarriage. So that's also an infertility issue. So couples having successful pregnancy, but couples' inability, I should say. You're right. That's what I think you included. Inability to have a successful pregnancy after how long? They've been trying for how long? A month? 2 months? It's defined based on 1 year. And what if they have intimacy once every 6 months? Would you say that's infertility? The answer is no. It has to be 1 year of inability to have a successful pregnancy based on kind of normal frequency intimacy, whatever normal frequency is, whatever that may be. I think in the literature, normal frequency of couples having intimacy has a wide range of what's considered to be normal frequency. I think generally it can be like 2-3 times a week, whatever the case may be. So it's, infertility is defined as the couple's inability to have a successful pregnancy after 1 year of normal attempts, normal frequency of intimacy, trying to have it. In terms of leaving out the causes of it,
in terms of way to treat it. So there's what's called assisted reproductive technology. Which basically involves two major approaches. One is called an IUI, used to be called kind of artificial insemination, it's more IUI now, and the other is IVF. So AI refers to artificial insemination. It most specifically is called IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. In the halachic term, it's called hazra'a melachutit, artificial insemination. But intrauterine insemination, more technically in terms of clinical. And then IVF is in vitro fertilization. Basically, what artificial insemination or intrauterine insemination does, we're limiting our discussion to the husband and wife themselves. Well, there are assisted reproductive technologies that can involve donors of sperm, donors of eggs, can involve surrogate carriers. We're not going to get into that. We don't have time. But just focusing on the basics of assisted reproductive technology involving the husband and wife. So artificial insemination, if for some reason, whatever reason may be, pregnancy is not able to be accomplished as a result of normal intercourse or intimacy. Perhaps that may be due to the husband not having enough sperm. So one way to, or something within the female reproductive tract that's kind of inhibiting the movement. So what you can do is you can take the husband's sperm and procedurally, the doctor can take his sperm sample with the millions of, let's say, sperm in it, and place it inside the uterus, going back here. Instead of having the husband deposit it in the vaginal tract and having to go all the way, they take the sperm and they deposit like high up in the uterus, much closer to the fallopian tubes, so that the possibility of it reaching the fallopian tubes and the eggs or oocyte that is hopefully waiting there, or hopefully will be there soon, is optimized. Kind of circumvent having the sperm travel through some of the journey, which makes it require less sperm, and also circumvents whatever environmental obstacles there may be to the sperm. It also optimizes, so it optimizes. That's intrauterine insemination. Everything else happens normally. The egg and the sperm fertilize normally. Implantation of the uterus occurs normally. The only technological part is that instead of the husband depositing the sperm and then the sperm go from there, a physician takes the man's sperm and places it in the uterus. In order to do so, where did he get the husband's sperm? So the husband has to produce a semen sample. How's he going to produce a semen sample? So there are ways to produce it, but the basic notion is that he's going to produce a semen sample that is not being deposited in his wife's reproductive tract. It's not going to be, generally speaking, in the context of a normal intercourse. He's going to produce a sperm sample, a semen sample. So the question halakhically, which is the single most important halakhic issue in terms of permitting or not permitting these technologies, is again the issue of hotsoas zera levatolo. Why? Because it's I'm sorry?
It's not levatolo.
So it's not in the context of normal intercourse, but why do you say that it's not levatolo, which is consistent with most poskim?
The only reason why you're making a hotsoa of zera is to put it into a uterus.
Correctly.
It's even quicker.
So you're saying not levatolo because it is for what purpose? Therefore, it's for the purpose of
the exact purpose of
pru or vu, which also raises the issue: Do you fulfill the mitzvah pruvu this way? Which is also a discussion in the poskim, but many poskim assume one does fulfill it this way.
Well, there are no guarantees, right?
No, well, let's say it's successful. So will you say that this couple fulfilled mitzvah pruvu if it wasn't quite 100% naturally? So that's a discussion in the poskim, but the general assumption, general consensus, certainly of major poskim, is that you do fulfill the mitzvah pruvu. The fact that it wasn't accomplished through a normal intercourse is not as important as the fact that it is the husband's sperm in the female reproductive tract that does accomplish the goal of pruvu, having children. So let's assume you do fulfill the mitzvah pruvu. So then you can't say that's the general, like Shlomo Zalman, Rav Eliashiv as well, that Moshe, that it's not a tzar zera levatola, because it's not levatola, it's for the purpose of having a child. The fact that it's being produced exterior to the female reproductive tract of the woman, however he's producing it, I'm not going to go into that, we don't have the time to go into that, but there are different methods. If you look, there's a wonderful book by Dr. Richard Grazi, in English and translated into Hebrew. There's a chapter about male production of sperm that's authored by Rabbi Dr. Yoel Jacobowitz, who's a gastroenterologist in Baltimore. I think he lives on the Neri Yisrael campus. His father was Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz, the chief rabbi of Great Britain years ago, who wrote the original book of Jewish bioethics. So in Dr. Grazi's book, Dr. Jacobowitz has a whole hierarchy of what methods to use for a man to produce sperm. So then you can look for the details in there if you wish. So it's hard to tell it's not. So that's a general assumption. But to point out that there are poskim who say that it's usher, because it's levatola, it's not in the normal context of intercourse, it's levatola, even though it's for that purpose. General consensus is not like that chumra, like that opinion, I should say, but because of what you said. Fine. IVF is in vitro fertilization. In vitro fertilization, more of the process is done outside of the female reproductive tract, which makes it in some ways more of an issue. But in vitro fertilization, basically what occurs is that in addition to the husband's sperm, we also basically obtain the woman's egg from her ovaries. Generally speaking, IVF is associated with what's known as ovarian stimulation. You don't need to know this term, but it's good to know it. Ovarian stimulation, where basically the woman's ovaries are stimulated to produce more than the normal one mature egg per cycle. They're stimulated hormonally to try to produce numerous eggs that are mature. There are women who will produce maybe 4 or 5 or 6 or 12 or 18 or 20, depending on the woman. A younger woman will be able to produce more. And what they do is, rather than allow the woman to ovulate, they basically retrieve, they aspirate, they remove the mature eggs, they put it in like a petri dish, and they mix each one separately, they mix each egg with sperm from the husband. So he produces a sperm sample for the Mr. Furuvu, and she is stimulated to produce multiple mature eggs, which are surgically removed from her ovaries prior to her ovulating them. And they're mixed together in a petri dish, and they're allowed to basically fertilize outside of the womb. So unlike IUI, where everything else other than the depositing of the sperm is normal, fertilization, implantation, here, for whatever medical conditions or reasons that infertility kind of doesn't allow this other method to be successful, and it's very common that a couple may start with IUI, it's also much less expensive than IVF, and they may undergo several rounds of IUI, and if they don't succeed, then they may go to IVF, because IVF has a very high success rate, similar to the success rate of a normal fertile couple being able to have a pregnancy. So IVF can be very successful. It happens to be also very expensive, $10,000, whatever it may be, and generally insurances, some may pay, some may not. In Eretz Yisrael, the government pays for IVFs for couples, I think up to two children, if they have had no children. If I'm not mistaken, the government there pays for IVF for all couples to have
you know, if they have no children, I think up to two children. So they fertilize, and then they take, so what's fertilized becomes an embryo, and then the embryo starts to grow outside of the woman in this petri dish. They give it nutrition, they give it, they give it hamantaschen, they give it whatever they give. They give it, that's not what they give. They give it nutritional support, and generally speaking, sometimes 3 days after this process began, sometimes 5 days, they transfer it back into the woman's uterus, and then it implants naturally. So basically, you've circumvented all the problems. Everything is occurring outside, technologically. Both the male and female cells are combined, fertilized. The embryo starts to grow. It grows for 3 to 5 days, then it's transferred back into the uterus, and then it implants, and everything goes from there. It's a very successful treatment. The issue here again is Hotzah Zera Levatola, but again, based on your Svara, it's for the purpose of trying to have children in Peru or Vu. So it's not Levatola for that reason. So sometimes Levatola is not an issue if the normal intercourse is there, even if it may not succeed. And sometimes it's not Levatola, even if the normal intercourse is not there, if it's for the purpose of trying to have children in Peru or Vu. And there are other detailed discussions associated with children born from this, and the issues of donor eggs and donor sperm, which we're not getting into. One thing that I want to just mention, and that's what I wanted to show you in a video, because it's just fascinating to see it, and you can kind of see the relationship between an egg and sperm, is there is a procedure which you do not need to know. So that's the end of our material, basically. And that is the issue of it's a procedure called ICSI, which you don't need to know. But what it involves is sometimes, particularly if the man produces very few sperm, they can actually take one individual sperm cell and inject it into the woman's egg in vitro, outside of the woman's body, and then let that kind of fertilize and grow and then transfer back. It's called intracytoplasmic sperm injection. You should also know, just for your own knowledge, about PGD, which is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, that before transferring the embryo, they can check for certain genetic diseases from the embryo. It's called pre-implantation, before implanting it or transferring back, genetic diagnosis, which can obviate issues. That comes back to our discussion about potentially using contraception if we're a couple, both of whom are carriers for, let's say, cystic fibrosis. They can use in vitro fertilization. They can check the embryo before it goes back into the woman to see if it is potentially affected or not. So I just wanted to show you that video, and then we'll, I guess, call it from here. Yes?
The PGD is also the process used in gender preselection.
Yes, you can use PGD for gender preselection, which is another topic, which sometimes is appropriate for medical reasons, depending on the genetic disease, if it's a sex-linked disease. And there's sometimes there are discussions in the postgame about having a male versus a female in certain situations where it's not based on medical, but other considerations that are more personal or emotional or privacy issues, where sometimes the postgame do permit it, but that's a discussion. Right, potentially with the Kohen, if there's a issue of a Kohen, if there's a donor involved.
Right.
By the way, I should just mention to you regarding the issue of contraception, there's an article that was written a while ago by Rav Schechter from YU, and I think some of the editing or reading was actually done by Rabbi Moshe Rosenberg, you know, here in the Shul Eitz Chaim here. It was in the RJJ Journal, Journal of Contemporary Halachic Problems, RJJ Journal. So it's been a few decades, I think, but it's a good article called Halachic Aspects of Family Planning. If you Google it, you'll find it. Halachic Aspects of Family Planning. Just wanted to show you this video of ICSI. ICSI video. Let me see. Let's look at this one. See this one. Oh, that's a long one. I don't want to show you that one. That's too long. Here. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Let's look at that one.
So basically what we've got is we've got an injection pipette, which is a fine glass pipette that we've just now collected a sperm into. Basically, what we want to be able to do is to get that sperm so that the actual, we suck it up with the actual tail so that the head is actually going to be first into the actual egg itself.
This is an egg.
Now on the left-hand side, what you can see is a larger glass pipette, which is the holding pipette.
It's holding
the
egg.
And that's used to hold the egg in place. Up there at 12 o'clock, you can now see that we're positioning that polar body. So that's the thing that was showing to us that the egg is mature. And you'll be able to see that there's no cells now around the outside of the egg, as I said, so that we can tell whether or not that egg is.
This around the O side of the egg is not part of the egg. It's a protein coat around the egg that the egg generally hatches from around day 5 after fertilization. But they're going to have to penetrate. In fact, when the sperm fertilizes, the sperm has to first penetrate through this protein coat to get to the egg itself. So that's what's just so you...
mature and suitable to have a sperm injected in. Now what we're going to do is we're going to basically bring that sperm down closer to the end of the pipette before we actually
the sperm.
Then go inside and pierce the actual.
By the way, notice the difference in size between the male sperm and the female oocyte. Female oocyte is so much larger than male sperm. That should give us all some humility.
Actual membrane and the actual ulema. We then suck back until there is a break or a snap, and you could have seen possibly if you were closely looking that the sperm quickly goes back. That then basically allows us to be able to put the sperm inside the egg itself and then remove the pipette out, which is what we've done. We now are going to...
Let me go back to the... Because I interrupted it.
Inject it in. Now what we're going to do is we're going to basically bring that sperm down closer to the end of the pipette before we actually then go inside and pierce the actual membrane and the actual ulema. We then suck back until there is a break or a snap, and you could have seen possibly if you were closely looking that the sperm quickly goes back. That then basically allows us to be able to put the sperm inside the egg itself and then remove the pipette out, which is what we've done. We now are going to remove the egg from off the holding pipette, and that's just using the other pipette and just making sure that it's not still attached. Here you can see that the egg itself is still showing the line or the actual area where we've just gone with the actual needle, injection needle. What will happen though is over time that'll disappear and you won't be able to see that anymore. And then basically roughly around about 18 to 20 hours later, we check for signs of fertilization.
Okay, I want you guys to miss Mara. So. It's basically log off.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Have a good